This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. For more than 100 years, a bitter memory of a brutal massacre has lingered with Wilmington's African Americans. After the Civil War, Wilmington became a mecca for blacks in the South. Black-owned businesses lined Wilmington's streets, while African-Americans held positions in local government. By the 1890s, it had become one of the state's most prosperous cities, and it was predominantly black. But in 1898, an armed group of white supremacists planned and executed a coup d'etat that overthrew the city government. The coup left more than a dozen people dead and exiled a large portion of the city's black community. For more than 100 years, it was known only as the Wilmington Race Riot. A new documentary, Wilmington on Fire, shows how the bloody event provided a template for violent suppression of black rights that enforced Jim Crow for more than half a century, and it served to bolster white supremacy in the South. The documentary screens tomorrow at Thalian Hall in Wilmington. My guest now is the film's director, Chris Everett. Chris, welcome to the program.
Hey, how are you doing today?
I'm doing well. I gave us a sketch of Wilmington in the 1890s. Maybe you can fill in some of the details and tell us more about what was going on in that city and just how prosperous and populous it was.
Oh, sure. I would say prior to the 1898 massacre, Wilmington was North Carolina's largest city back then, heavy in port activity. That led to a lot of African Americans to come to the city because of the jobs at the ports, and also the education. The educational system there was real good for African Americans. So you had a lot of literate African Americans back then because the school systems were real good as well. So Wilmington became sort of like a mecca for African Americans, not only throughout the state of North Carolina, but in South Carolina, people would come from Charleston and in that area as well to come to Wilmington to work and start a new life for their families and everything.
This emergence of a middle class, a black middle class, but also black and white middle class and working class folks who now had money, also was part of what built a fusionist political party in the state of North Carolina that was quite successful in the 1890s. Tell us about the fusionist party.
Oh, yes, the fusionist movement started with we had a lot of black Republicans and also white populists who pretty much were farmers like that. And they kind of merged together in this thing called fusion. And with the whole fusion movement, they were able to elect their people into office and kind of, I would say, make the laws and policies kind of fair and balanced for everyone. But you had a Democratic Party system that didn't really subscribe to that. And that's when they began to kind of plot and plan and thus happened with the 1898 massacre.
So what was happening here in North Carolina, a fusionist movement, was also part of the larger populist movement across the country where farmers and other people who had been disadvantaged mostly by corporate banking practices and those who had been privileged by those practices got together and said, hey, wait a minute, we're all getting the bad end of this deal. And so we saw populist politics all across the country. The fusionist movement actually put a governor in the governor's mansion in the late part of the century. Isn't that right?
Yes. Daniel Russell, he became our governor in North Carolina back then. He was our fusionist governor. And that was really the whole thing with the massacre, was to first take that General Assembly away and then in 1900 get the governorship back from the fusionist movement.
So you've got this party of privilege, the Democratic Party at the time. These are the old landowners who were really disserved by actually having to work for a living. They didn't have to do that before the Civil War. Now they'll have to do their own work. So they want this back, and they do it. And tell us about what we know about a race riot in Wilmington. We're going to kind of fast forward a little bit, because for over 100 years, there was an event in 1898 that was billed as a race riot. And for most of white North Carolina, that's all they knew it by.
Yeah. Well, yeah, for years it was called a riot, pretty much basically saying that it was something that spontaneously happened, which was not true at all. That's how they painted that picture for years and years. But it really was a thought out plan by the Democratic Party and these white supremacists during that time. But the massacre happened on November 10th in 1898. And it was pretty much a lot of bloodshed. It was a bloody attack on the African-American community in Wilmington and also the biracial legislation of the city of Wilmington during that time. And it's called a coup d'etat is because they actually overthrew the biracial legislation after they killed people and banished them from the city. They pretty much took control of the government. But also throughout the state, they did certain things such as voter intimidation, voter fraud, cheating during the elections for the General Assembly. So like I said earlier, they needed to do that in order to win the governorship in 1900, which they did.
Only the early part of the 21st century where we've seen the actual documentation, the plans were laid, the letters. Some of the most important people in the state, Charles Aycock, who would later become governor, the founder of the News and Observer newspaper, Josephus Daniels. These are all the people who are conspiring and writing to each other to plan to shoot an elected government out of office. Tell us about how that plan came apart together, but I want to hear more about the Democratic Party because there was a cell within the Democratic Party that really helped plan this whole thing.
Yes, you had different factions. You had such groups such as the White Government Union. And we show this in the film as well, actual documentation of some of their bylaws and constitutions, saying that there has been a division amongst the white man. And that pretty much was that the populist party and the Democratic Party and the white government union was created to bring those white men back from take them away from the fusionist movement and bring them back into the Democratic Party. So that way they could get control over the state politics, local, county, state, all of that. So that's really what the White Government Union pretty much was. It was like an action committee of galvanizing white men all over the state to let's get back all the white men's vote to the white side. There's been a division where you have Negroes taking over, which wasn't true at all. Black people really weren't taking over anything.
You had democracy taking over, which scared people who rule by privilege and power. Yeah. So the Democratic Party forms this within the party, the White Government Union. What's interesting about this, too, and it's in your film, you talk to a guy named Kent Chatfield, who's a researcher.
Yes.
And he talks about that White Government Union, how it was formulated, but the fact that it's really technically still on the books. Let's listen to Kent Chatfield.
When the North Carolina Democratic Party's executive committee created the White Government Union in 1897, they did so by a vote. Well, we know that it was created. We have their constitution and bylaws. It even says within the constitution and bylaws, it was created by the Democratic Party to do this. What I'd like to know is, when was the vote taken to abolish their secret political society? I'd like the North Carolina Democratic Party Executive Committee to answer that question, because I've never heard that it was ever abolished.
So what you're saying is it's probably still going on?
I think it's alive and well in North Carolina.
That's a clip from the documentary Wilmington on Fire. The film screens tomorrow at Thalian Hall in Wilmington. My guest is the film's director, Chris Everett. Let's talk more about that effort. It was systematic here in North Carolina and across the South to win whites away from a growing union, with particularly a merger of interest between poor whites, essentially, and African Americans. That and a lot of that effort had to do with stirring up fears about what was happening to white women, right?
Yes. They use, I would say, propaganda campaigns. Because when you look at it, majority of the people, like you said earlier, Josephus Daniels, and also here in Wilmington, William H. Bernard, who owned the Star News, all these newspapers around the state, the main players behind the massacre own newspapers. So they use the newspapers to propagate that propaganda all around. So they would make up crazy stories about black men raping white women, or if black people get all educated and get jobs and get all this money, they're just going to take over. And, you know, so it just really brought a mass hysteria to a lot of people and brought in that fear across a lot of white citizens across the state. But you also have to realize a lot of people couldn't read back then. So they used a lot of those political cartoons where, you know, if you're just looking up old newspapers, you'll see these crazy political cartoons just making fun of black people, calling them lazy or corrupt and all that stuff. So they used imagery to further their propaganda campaign.
This takes us to Alex Manley, who was a newspaper publisher, an African-American newspaper publisher in Wilmington, who pushed back. Tell us about Alex Manley.
Well, Alex Manley, he was a African-American man who had the a daily newspaper in Wilmington back then called the Wilmington Daily Record. But he could actually pass for a white guy. But he lived his life as an African-American man. There was a story by, not really a story, but a speech by Rebecca Felton, Latimer Felton, from Georgia. And she made a speech called Women on the Farm, pretty much saying that, you know, white men need to stand up for their women because you have black men out here raping them on these farms where they're doing work, picking cotton and stuff like that. And white men need to take up the mantle and do something about it. And there are different stories saying that Manley didn't actually write the response, but it came from his paper, so he had to take fault for it. But in the response of Manley's paper, he pretty much was saying that it's not really rape majority of time when it's, you know, when this thing happens with black men and white women. It's only when the white woman gets caught, this when she says it's rape. And they used that. A lot of the newspapers back then kind of said, okay, we're going to use this as our fuel to the fire to take it to the next level. So they printed that response all over the state with cartoons. They put it in all the newspapers and just reprinted it.
So that becomes the proximate cause. Ultimately, the people do take to the streets. Manley's newspaper business is burned to the ground. Tell us about the actual events surrounding the rioting that was what we now know as the coup d'etat.
Yeah. Well, Manley, his newspaper was closer to the downtown area, I say a few months prior before the massacre, but he was already getting threats of it getting burned down. So the landlord told him to move. And that's why he had to move to the actual next location, which actually got burned down. But the massacre, you know, it was just a pretty much a slaughter of black people. First, they burned down Manley's newspaper building, but Manley was already warned ahead of time to get out of town. I think he got out of town probably a couple days prior. And they burned his building down to the ground. And then also, they went just across the African-American community during that time. It was called Brooklyn, the Brooklyn area of Wilmington. And it was just an onslaught, a slaughter, man, of just black people running, hiding in the cemetery for weeks. Also, it was a banishment campaign of a lot of the prominent African-American figures, like your pastors, your business owners, some of your political folks during that time. So it was just a mass exodus of African-Americans that totally shifted the population of Wilmington back then.
So they're driven out of town or flee for whatever, but whether they fled or were driven out, obviously it was under threat of violence. And then the land is simply taken, stolen by white people.
Yes. And see, that's the thing we talk about in the film, because over the years, people say, well, you know, there's no land been taken. But we found like some new research of documentation of actually how they actually did it. We found an old deed book that was in one of the guys who was part of the conspirators, William Barry McCoy. He had an actual deed book in his old files, archives and stuff. And he's had the deed book in there for over 100 years. So we found all these lists of properties and deeds and everything that really haven't been touched or even researched yet. So they were very, very clever on how they did this thing and also how they actually covered it up for all these years.
Well, you did speak to one of the descendants of a black Wilmington resident who was driven out of town. You spoke to Faye Chaplin about that very subject. Let's listen.
I just feel like in some form or fashion, they should compensate. You go to Wilmington, all the areas downtown Wilmington, near the battleship, all of those streets around that property, that is land that at some point in time, Thomas Miller had a portion of that land. He owned quite a bit of that land around there. And for me to be a decedent of him, I look at it, you know, I go there, I see all the condos being built, I see all of the development in the area, and just think, part of that should be ours. You know, we were like stripped of our rights to a lot of his things because of color.
That's a clip from the documentary Wilmington on Fire. The film screens tomorrow at Thalian Hall in Wilmington. My guest is the film's director, Chris Everett. The execution and forcing out of office a duly elected city council and mayor is a violation of North Carolina law and federal law. What did William McKinley do about this, who was president at the time?
McKinley didn't do anything. And that's what kind of makes the the coup that happened in Wilmington significant, because we've had actual other coups in America even before the 1898 massacre. But what makes this one different is with the other ones, the federal government actually came in and reversed that government from even staying in office and everything. But with this one, they didn't. And it was a few factors. One, you had people at the state level who were actually behind the massacre as well, telling them one thing, pretty much telling them that, you know, it's okay. It's only a few people that were killed. And that was the story they were putting out. And also a few people told them that if you bring troops down here, we might have another civil war on our hands. So, you know, it's just black people getting harmed. Who cares? So let's just let it happen. And that's pretty much what the federal government, you know, pretty much said back then.
Now, that story had been known, as we said, for over 100 years as the Wilmington Race Riot. None of these details had been widely known until just maybe 15 years ago. Tell us, but the story has been alive in African-American communities for a long time. Tell us about how it lived and particularly how it resurfaced during the Wilmington 10 in the 1970s.
Yeah, for years, the story's been around not only in the black community in Wilmington, but also the white community as well. And it's pretty much like, I would call it like folklore, you know, when you're on your porch and you're talking about certain stories, certain events that happened. But I would say it really, really came to the full surface in the 70s when you had the Wilmington 10 situation happen here in Wilmington, North Carolina. And that when that situation happened, and also when Martin Luther King got assassinated in 68, when you had riots in Wilmington, that's another event that kind of brought the whole racial talk back to the surface in Wilmington. And people just started talking about 1898, because you still had certain people that were probably little kids back then living in the 60s and early 70s. So I know when we talked to Alex Manley's grandson, Dr. Lewin Manley, he talked about when he would come up here and visit his aunts back then. And he would talk to him and he would want to find out more things, what happened about 1898. And whenever he would bring it up, he said it would just get a cloud would just come over their face and they would never want to talk about it at all.
Of course, the failure of the federal government to act gave permission all across the South to use a system of violence to enforce Jim Crow. And it was widely reported. Newspapers were, in fact, pointing to North Carolina as the signal, the green light to now use all forms of terrorism to take away black civil rights. And that had been part of the story for the next 60 years or so. What about the legacy today? What's the story in Wilmington today?
Well, I would say when they did the actual state report, I would say they finally completed about 2006, 2007. You had a lot of talk started to go around Wilmington about 1898 again, because you had an actual full state report on it. But today, it's not really a lot of talk about it. I would say what we've done with the film has really brought it back to light and got the conversation going again. That's one of the reasons why I wanted to do the film in the first place, is to keep the fire going, keep the momentum going. Don't lose sight of what the goal is. And we really need to deal with this history. So I think this film has actually, and I've been filming it for 3 years and just promoting it and always putting it out here in the city of Wilmington, has really stirred it back up again, that conversation.
Chris Everett, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
My guest is Chris Everett. He's the director of the documentary Wilmington Fire. It looks at the 1898 Wilmington Massacre and coup d'etat. It screens tomorrow at Thalian Hall in Wilmington. Just ahead, we look at the prequel to Peter Pan at Playmakers in Chapel Hill. Stay tuned.